I have to confess before I start, I got back from Rome a week ago tonight, just about this time at Dulles Airport, and since then I've given 6 lectures in 4 different cities, not all of them on the Synod, by the way, and so if I slip to the ground, don't call 911, just put a pillow under my head and let me rest for a while. I was very honored to be invited by Father Thomas Joseph White to come and speak with you tonight. Dante is one of my great loves, and I have a personal story about this. You can't tell in many audiences, but maybe this is one of them. My brother was a priest in Connecticut now, was in the minor seminary, and I was home from my freshman year in college, and he was telling me about this wonderful poem that they were reading in his seminary, and I ought to take a look at it. So he handed me a copy of John Ciardi's translation of the Inferno, and I went upstairs in my parents' home to the bedroom that we both shared, and 2 hours later I came down, you know, with my eyes sort of glazed, and he said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said to him, "I think I'm an Aristotelian." And I still am, actually. It's a true story. I mean, it's the way that the soul somehow responds to these things. Now, I was very curious, Father White. I forget where I am even right now. But he invited me to speak about the importance that the incarnation has and the way that it changes the way we understand certain things. And he said in his email to me, "You know, why don't you do something about like how those souls are still individual in paradise or something like that?" And it's a very intriguing idea, and I was very flattered that he thought I could address such a subject, but I was flattered but not so foolish that I actually wanted to take it on. What I decided to do instead was to talk with you tonight about the Purgatorio. Because most of you, how many of you have actually read the Purgatorio? Ah, quite a few, actually. Oh, that's interesting. Most people, you know, even in these Western Civ courses, usually only read the Inferno. And so you get one idea of Dante from that. Very few people make it all the way through the Paradiso. And the Paradiso is very hard. You know, I've been reading it since I was a freshman in college. And what you see when you read the Paradiso is that even Dante, the character, and we're going to, as we go through this lecture tonight, we have to remember there are 2 Dantes. There's Dante the character, who's in the poem. And then there's Dante the poet, who's writing the poem. And if we want to understand the art of the beautiful, we need to see how those 2 different entities play back and forth. But it's the paradise is so far above us. I mean, I love that poem. I've read it. I can't tell you how many times I've read it. But even Dante, the character, keeps talking about how the light in paradise is so strong he can't bear it, and he just very slowly gets acclimated to it, and so he can rise up to the highest levels. And curiously, when he gets to the very end of the paradise, before he has the beatific vision, there's more and more imagery about being a little child. And so it's very hard to get to that point where the soul is open to that degree of illumination and that degree of simplicity. So as ambitious as Father Thomas Joseph White wanted me to be tonight, I'm not going to do that for you. The Inferno that most of us are familiar with is, I think, a little more self-evident, although maybe doesn't lend itself to our topic, the art of beauty, quite the same way. I think it's a very beautiful poem, and evil can be described in a very striking, penetrating, spiritually fruitful way, and we have to recognize the fact that there's evil. But the Purgatory is something that's a little bit more us, right? It's a little bit more human, because it's still in the midst of those struggles that we're all familiar with in our lives. Now, for those of you who haven't read the Divine Comedy, just very quickly what the structure is. There's a character, by the way, in Walker Percy's novel, The Second Coming, who's mocked because he's a lapsed Baptist, and he reads Dante for the structure. Walker Percy says, "Who reads Dante for the structure?" You know, the greatest spiritual poem possibly ever written. But it's worth paying attention to the structure, because the structure tells us many things, and I'll point out some places in this lecture where the structure tells us some things that if we're not attentive to, we miss in what Dante is trying to say. So the structure, simply, is that the whole of the Divine Comedy begins in a dark wood, as many of you know, and it ends with a beatific vision. And along the way, there are 100 cantos. A canto is about, typically about 125 to 150 lines. And the Inferno has 34. The first canto, maybe even the first and second canto, most scholars think is a, kind of an introduction. The Purgatory has 33, and the Paradise has 33. So it's kind of evenly divided, 33, 33, 33, with a, for a total of 100 cantos. Very interesting structure. And then the rhyme scheme is what's called terza rima. It's three rhymes intertwined like this, and obviously reflective of the Trinity. The idea of the Trinity built right into the structure of that poem, verse after verse after verse. Now, Dante is not the only medieval poet or the only medieval writer to pay attention to structure. The medievals tended to think that numbers and balance and structure were themselves indicative of what God did when he created the world. So, you know, we have to recognize that sort of a broad medieval approach. But Dante has some, I think, particular ways that he uses the structure that are helpful for us. Now, there's all kinds of poetry in these 100 cantos. And by that I mean that there is poetry as we're kind of normally used to it in American English, what we would describe as beautiful verses. There are allegories. Obviously, the Middle Ages relied a lot on allegorical interpretation. Dante says about his Divine Comedy that it is polysemous. It has multiple meanings, the way that Scripture has multiple meanings. And as you go through a poem like the Purgatory, you see all sorts of different uses of poetry and the art of the beautiful to convey this ultimate spiritual vision that Dante is trying to provide us with. I was hoping that Father Thomas Joseph White would be here because I wanted to kind of prod him a little bit, because I think one of the interesting things that I hope I get to be able to talk about today is the way that Dante even turns scholastic philosophy into poetry. And it's an interesting point in the modern world, because if you want to talk about the art of the beautiful can't just be the pretty. It can't just be the attractive. There has to be something in true beauty. And this is, you know, I use this contemporary phrase for our title tonight. It's complicated. You know, it's not a very straightforward thing. Not everything that attracts us is true beauty. And we'll get to that in a minute. But it's amazing that Dante's great genius is capable even of taking what are otherwise pretty difficult scholastic, philosophical, and theological terms and use them as those terms, but use them in poetry in a way that I think will, I'll try to convince you, has a serious importance. Now, another one of my sort of obsessive literary preoccupations, Charles Peguy once said about Dante, kind of dismissed him, he said, "Dante is just a tourist." He's kind of going by all these, you know, if you've read any of Dante, you know that mostly actually what happens is it's mostly a dramatic interchange. And much of the poem develops because he meets people, the damned souls in hell, people who are purging their sins in purgatory, and then the saved in paradise. But this is quite wrong. This is quite wrong because Dante knows, Dante the writer knows as much as Dante the character in the poem, that he himself is involved in every one of these sins. And in a way, you could almost say that, like most of us, when you read that poem, you recognize certain things about yourself as you encounter these souls that are of a certain kind. And one of the complications, one of the beautiful complications in the Divine Comedy is at the beginning, when Dante's in that dark wood, he sees this mountain, and the sun is at the top of it, and he says, "Oh, thank God, I, you know, get out of this dark wood." And he can't do it. He can't do it because his sins and other things are preventing him from going forward. There are three beasts, you know, that are there that prevent him from going forward. And he realizes he has to go by a different way. He has to see and know what is evil in the world so that he can be freed from that and then begin the real climb. Because purgatory, in Dante's imagination, is a mountain. And the first thing we want to notice about the purgatory is that it harks back to that mountain in the dark wood in the first canto of Inferno. But now, he comes up out of the ground with Virgil, his guide. He comes up out of the ground, and now there's this great mountain with terraces, yeah, going up. At one point in the poem, he says that this is the mountain that makes straight what the world made crooked, you know, by going up this mountain. So, let's read some poetry, okay? We're at the bottom of this mountain. Dante and Virgil have gone all the way to the bottom of hell, where they see Satan, who's frozen in ice. And I say this is the kind of Chinese handcuff that we had when we were kids. The more you try to pull out of it, the tighter it gets, you know? Well, Satan has fallen from heaven. He's plunged into the center of the earth, and he's frozen in ice. And the more he flaps his wings to try to escape, the more firmly he's frozen in the ice. And this is a beautiful image of what real sin is. Sin is trying to avoid the order and the reality and the beauty of what God created. The truth, the goodness, and the beauty of what God created. And there's no place to flee to. You know, all those sins are attempts to replace God's order, God's beauty, God's goodness with something that cannot replace it, because there's no other world than the world that God created. So now at the beginning of purgatory, Dante is going to begin to learn. He's seen the evils, he's freed from those evils in a way, and now he's going to begin to follow himself this path upward in the mountain. So let me just read some verses. I'm going to read some poetry tonight to you. This is the way it begins. To run its course through smoother water, to the small bark of my wit now hoists its sail, leaving the cruel seed behind. Now I shall sing the second kingdom, there where the soul of man is cleansed, made worthy to ascend to heaven. Here from the dead let poetry rise up, O sacred muses, since I am yours. Here let Calliope arise to accompany my song with those same chords whose force so struck the miserable magpies. I'll come back to this. That hearing them, they lost all hope of pardon. Sweet color of oriental sapphire, hovering in the calm and peaceful aspect of intervening air, pure to the horizon, pleased my eyes once more as soon as I had left the morbid air that had afflicted both my chest and my eyes. The fair planet that emboldens love, smiling, lit up the east, veiling the fishes in her train. I turned to the right, and fixing my attention on the other pole, I saw four stars, not seen but by those first on earth. The very sky seemed to rejoice in their bright glittering. O widowed region of the north, denied that sight. Now, these are about the first 24 lines of the purgatory, and a lot is going on here. There's this recognition that he's in this new realm. There's this invocation of the muses, the magpies, by the way, who he says, I want you to inspire me with the same inspiration that defeated the magpies, or what are called the Pierides, these nine foolish women who are singers who chose to challenge the muses. It's not a good idea to challenge the gods, even in pagan terms. And they're turned into magpies. And the reason is they sang the songs of domination, of giants rebelling against the gods. Whereas the muses sing about fertility and beauty and harmony, and they conquer by that other type of poetry. So Dante is laying down here right at the very, very beginning. I mean, he's a very ambitious man, and he has a pretty high opinion of himself, if truth be told. But he's recognizing right here that the kind of poetry that leads to spiritual vision is something different than self-assertion, right? There's a humility to it. There's a recognition that you are not yourself the origin of the beauty that you're going to sing, that it comes from elsewhere. And that's built right into the very beginning here. The other thing I want to point out to you is that imagery. He comes up and now he says that the smoke of hell had stung the lungs and the eyes. Now he's in this clear air, oriental sapphire, you can imagine this deep blue. And he's taking his orientation from where? From the stars, right? He sees the planet of love, Venus, in the constellation Pisces, which is the place where the first morning star came up at the creation, the medievals believed. And he also sees four stars in the form of a cross. It's the Southern Cross. We don't know how Dante knew about the Southern Cross, because you can't see the Southern Cross from the Northern Hemisphere. But he mentions the Southern Cross. Maybe this came by way of Marco Polo or one of the early explorers. But Dante knows about it somehow. And it isn't just four stars. We soon learn that these are the four cardinal virtues. Because what happens is, as the poets are kind of orienting themselves and they're so happy to be out under God's heaven again, a figure pops up out of nowhere. For those of you who've read Purgatory, I have to say, after many readings, I'm always surprised at this, because the figure who pops up, you expect it's going to be a saint or somebody. It's Cato the Younger, who's a Stoic philosopher in ancient Rome, who committed suicide. Because when Caesar destroyed the Republic and instituted the Empire, Cato read Plato's Phaedo all night and decided that the freedom of the soul was more important than just continued mere existence. So Dante is departing a little bit from Catholic theology here, but he's drawing a point out of it. And Virgil actually says to Cato, because Virgil's an ancient Roman too, and they recognize one another. This is what Virgil says. May it please you to welcome his arrival, since he's in search of liberty, which is so dear, as he well knows, who gives his life for it. So a theme gets introduced here, and oddly by this pagan window, right? But in a way we understand this almost in naturalistic terms, that anyone who is willing to sacrifice his life for the true good and for virtue is almost in a way anticipating the sacrifice that Christ makes on the cross. Now, yeah. That said, I'm not entirely happy with having a suicide here at the beginning of the purgatory either. But Dante is given to these strange images and unusual persons, and they stop and they make you stop and think, why is that person there? Now, what Cato says to them is, okay. They explain to him that the Virgin Mary and St. Lucy and Beatrice sent Virgil to help rescue Dante. They went through hell, they came up, and he says, okay, all right. I thought that maybe you guys were trying to escape from hell, but all right, that's fine, if that's what you're going to do. So he says, you must go down to the shore of this island. And Virgil, get the dirt off him. He shouldn't go up and see the angels and God and whatnot with all that dirt from hell. Wash him and then gird him with a humble rush, with one of the rushes that's in the water. And the rushes survive because they will move with the tide and with the waves. They don't they're humble enough to not resist and move back and forth. And so there's another imagery, another kind of sense through this imagery of it requires humility and submission to what is, to reality, to even begin this process. I'd just like to read the end of that first canto to you, because I think it's very beautiful. Dawn was overtaking the darkness of the hour, which fled before it, and I saw and knew the distant trembling of the sea. We went along the lonely plain like someone who has lost the way and thinks he strays until he finds the road. When we came to a place where the dew can hold its own against the sun because it is protected by a breeze, my master gently spread his hands upon the grass, and I, who understood what he intended, raised my tear-stained cheeks, and he restored the color hell had obscured in me. Now came we to the empty shore. Upon those waters no man ever sailed who then experienced his return. There he girded me, as pleased another. What a wonder it was that the humble plant he chose to pick sprang up at once in the very place where he had plucked it. So not only is the humble rush pliable to reality, it's fertile. You know, it keeps springing up. Humility keeps springing up again. There's tremendous beauty here, and I wish people always ask me, what's the best translation of Dante? And I said, the best translation is the one you make when you learn Italian. I hope you get a sense of the beauty just of the imagery there. But you can imagine, if you took Shakespeare and translated him into Italian, or any poet that who you really like in English, you can imagine how much gets lost going from one language to another. But that kind of the beauty that we see just in the imagery here is doubled, tripled, quadrupled by the way that Dante uses language to express this. Now, it's worth saying there are two types of beauty here. You know, there's the beauty of the language and of the imagery, but there's also a spiritual beauty here. There's a true beauty here, something being expressed by these humble things that Dante is using in this very first canto of Purgatory, and is already orienting us toward what's going to happen in this ascent that he's going to make. Now, in Canto 2, the poets are trying to find their way back up to where they need to be, and they see this bright light, so bright that they can't even look at it, and they realize that it's a boat that's sort of flying over the water, and angel's wings, its wings are not even moving, but an angel is propelling this boat toward them. And as it draws near, they hear that the souls on board are singing what in the Middle Ages was numbered as Psalm 113, In Exitu Egypto Israel, which is when Israel went out of Egypt. In other words, it's the song of the Exodus. So those souls coming across the water to the island of Purgatory are singing in memory of the ancient Israelites, when the ancient Israelites escaped Egypt, which of course means sin in the imagery that we're following here. And they land and meet the two poets, and they're all saying hello to one another, and suddenly Dante sees someone he knew from Florence. Now, all throughout the Purgatory, this is one of the reasons why I chose it, the arts are presented. There's music, there's poetry, there are the psalms that we just saw in Egypto, in Exitu Egypto Israel. There are actually bas-reliefs. The proud up on the terrace of the proud are carrying these heavy stones on their back. Dante always has a punishment that fits the crime. And their noses are bent down, and they're looking at sort of bas-reliefs of examples of humility that contrast with the pride that they put on their own backs that bent them down. Well, Dante looks in this group of people, these souls who just disembarked from this holy ship, and he sees a musician, a friend of his, Casella, who set one of his own canzoni to music. And he says, "Casella, look at you! Hey, it's great! You know, they're trying to embrace, and since Casella is a soul and not a body anymore, his hands come right through the appearance of the body that he has." And Dante says this to him: "If a new law does not take from you memory or practice of the songs of love that used to soothe my every sorrow, please let me hear one now to ease my soul, for it is out of breath and spent, joined to my body coming here." And he quotes the first line of one of his poems. "Love that converses with me in my mind," he then began, "so sweetly, that the sweetness sounds within me still. My master and I, and all those standing near Casella, seemed untroubled, as if we had no other care." Now, these are souls that have just died, and or have recently died, and they come across in the boat, and Dante and Virgil have just come up from hell. And, you know, to hear his own poem, "Amor che nella mente mi ragiona," sung by a friend. And it's a poem that talks about love discoursing in my mind, actually reasoning in my mind. And you would think that love here is, the reasoning is sort of like in Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy. It's the truth about philosophy and how philosophy consoles, and the truth about how it speaks to the mind, to the highest part of the human soul. But what happens at this point is very interesting, because they're listening, they're enjoying this song, he says, as if we had no other care. And that's the problem. Because Cato shows up, and being the good Stoic that he is, he says, what is this, laggard spirits? What carelessness, what delay is this? Hurry to the mountain, and there shed the slough that lets not God be known to you. And they all scatter, Dante says, like pigeons who've been feeding on, breadcrumbs, and some noise scares them away. Even Virgil, who's sort of this, fairly formal character in the poem. Well, a sympathetic reader sees this and wants to say, well, hey, Cato, cut these guys a little bit of slack, will you? I mean, they just came out of hell. But the problem is that's all too human, a reaction. And what you see in the poem, if you pay attention here to the structure, is how slow most of us are. Dante doesn't say this, but how slow most of us are actually to begin that ascent that we all have to make eventually. When you get to heaven, once you reach the earthly paradise at the top of purgatory and you jump off into heaven, you're kind of like a lightning bolt shooting up into the sky. So that's not an effort. But we all have to make this effort. And Cato is urging these laggard spirits. Well, who are these laggard spirits? What you find as you read further into the Divine Comedy is that Dante and Virgil don't really enter purgatory proper until Canto 9 of the Purgatory. Now, in the Inferno, the famous inscription over the gates of hell, abandon all hope, all ye who enter here, that's in Canto 3. And as I said, the first two cantos are sort of introductory, he's lost, the three holy ladies ask Virgil to go down so essentially they enter hell at the very beginning of the real beginning of the poem. In heaven, the minute you're in the first canto of Paradiso, they're Dante and Beatrice, because Beatrice is now his guide, they're taking off. In purgatory, we don't read for the structure, but we notice the structure. We notice the structure here tells us that it takes a long time, even for these souls who are already saved, to enter that high gate, that first gate where there's a angel kind of standing at the top of these stairs that let them in. And the category of people who are milling around, and by the way, this is very beautifully described. If I had time, we don't really have time here, but I'd like to tell you about, there are these lazy people like Sordello, of someone he knew in his life, who are, they're so lazy they haven't even reached the level of sloth yet. And it's very, it's very funny to see a great poet kind of describe a guy who, there weren't cigarettes in those days, but you can imagine Sordello kind of, smoking. Yeah, hey, look, you guys get going. I'm not ready to go yet. And then there are the late repentant and those who were excommunicated and repented at the last moment. Then a very interesting category in a green valley, which is the valley of the princes. And Dante, of course, writes a lot about politics. He thinks one of the reasons why the world is going to hell in a handbasket is that the Roman Empire doesn't exist anymore, that there's no proper God-willed political authority to keep to keep the Italian city-states from going to war with one another all the time, right? But there's a lack that the people who have been charged by God to be the authorities over his people were derelict in their duty. And so those princes are in this very beautiful valley, and there's a beautiful allegory that takes place. But all that is there to tell us that, we're slow at this. We don't like having to undertake those very difficult purgations of our sins, right? I mean, these are the things that ultimately we have to do, but they're the, in one way, one of the most difficult things to do of all. Now, quite different from in the Inferno. If we look at the poetry of what happens in the Purgatory, even those punishments, as you start to go up the terraces, are in a sunlit kind of atmosphere. So it's not that dark, you know, smoky, noisy environment that you see in the Inferno. In Purgatory, there's a sense of being on a mountainside and out in the ocean and exposed to the light. And even at night, there are kind of there are beauties and there are songs sung and whatnot. My wife is a big fan of reading books about Purgatory, usually medieval books, usually very grim medieval books that say that Purgatory is sort of like hell, except you know that there'll be an end to it, unlike in hell. Well, that's not Dante's Purgatory. And obviously in the Middle Ages there were different views of what Purgatory is like. But there's a feeling to this that is both demanding and at the same time somehow hopeful and uplifting. Now, I'd like to kind of get to an idea of, is there some way to describe all these different forms of poetry that exist in the Divine Comedy? What is the art of beauty that Dante has in the Purgatory? And one of the ways that you can approach that is if you jump to Purgatory 24, Dante meets another friend, a poet called Bonaggiunta da Lucca, a guy he knew who was a slightly older poet in Italy than he was. And Bonaggiunta meets him, and he doesn't say, "Hey, didn't I see you on EWTN the other night?" What he says is, "Aren't you the author of the canzone Donne che avete intelletto d'amore, ladies who have understanding in love?" Another one of Dante's beautiful poems. And Dante says, "Yeah, that's me." He says, "You know," and he says, "You know, I love that poem." He said, "But I've always tried to figure out," because Dante was the most prominent member of a school called the Dolce Stil Nuovo, the sweet new style. And Bonaggiunta says to him, "I couldn't, you know, I'm older than you. I didn't understand this. What made you guys different than us?" And Dante says to him a very interesting thing. I'm going to read it to you in Italian first. He says, "Io mi son uno che quando amor mi ispira noto e a quel modo che dita dentro vo significando." He says, "I'm one of those people who when love inspires me, when love, amor mi ispira, love inspires me, I take note of it, noto. And in the way that it dictates to me inside, that's the way I manifest what it's inspired me to say." So this is Dante. Dante is the great poet of love, right? But what love? You know, there are all kinds of loves that are out there in the world. What does love dictate to Dante? Bonaggiunta hears this, and now he's fairly advanced. He's up in Purgatory 24, so he's on the verge of the earthly paradise. And he says, "Now I see what you guys are doing that I didn't do. You know, we didn't follow love closely the way you did." So, but what does love dictate? Now, here, if Father Thomas Joseph White were here, I would like to challenge him. What it dictates is truth, but an inspiring kind of truth. We see the breakout of the sins in a kind of an Aristotelian way in the Inferno. We see gradations of sanctity in the paradise. And in the Purgatory, there are the seven deadly sins, you know, starting with pride, ending with lust. At the center of the Purgatory, I'm not reading Dante only for the structure, but I am reading the structure. At the very center of the Purgatory in Canto 17 and 18, which is also the very center of the poem. Now, there are some modern theories associated with Leo Strauss and some other philosophers that in earlier times people hid their main message at the center of a text. Dante doesn't hide this very much because he puts this right at the center of this highly structured artistic creation. And he clearly wants this to be noticed as at the center. And here's what happens. Night has fallen, and you cannot climb the mountain of Purgatory when it's dark. This is sort of the imagery of the illumination of grace has to be with you. So there, he and Virgil are stuck halfway up this mountain, and Dante puts a question to Virgil. He says, "Sweet Father, tell me, what is the offense made clean here in this circle that we've reached? If our feet must rest, do not arrest your words." They're on the terrace of Slav, right? And Virgil says to him, "A love of good that falls short of its duty is here restored. Here in this place, here the slackened oar is pulled with greater force." It's fine. You know, they're in the terrace of Sloth. These are people who have not exerted themselves. But Dante wants to know more, and Virgil provides him with it. And this is what Virgil says, almost unprovoked by Dante. "Neither creator nor his creature, my dear son, was ever without love, whether natural or of the mind," he began. "And this you know, the natural is always without error, but the other may err in its chosen goal or through excessive or deficient vigor. While it is directed to the primal good, knowing moderation in its lesser goals, it cannot be the cause of wrongful pleasure. But when it bends to evil, or pursues the good with more or less than needed, then the creature works against his maker. In the Italian, this is very beautiful. He says, it's contra il fattore, against the one who did the making. Contra il fattore adovra sua fattura. So the creature, creator, you know, there's this sort of opposition. "From this you surely understand that love must be the seed in you of every virtue and every deed that merits punishment." So love is everywhere. And the way I like to explain this usually is, if you've ever read Augustine's Confessions, there's a phrase that's often quoted from Augustine's Confessions, "Pondus meum amor meus," that my love is my weight. And in a way, the whole Dantean universe, this whole Ptolemaic system, is the quality of your love determines where you are in this universal ranking, right? If you're absolutely taken by self-love, you're down there with Satan. You're weighed down by this false love. And then there are lesser sins, of course, even in hell, there are sins that are not as serious. And then in purgatory, as you purge from the more serious sins like pride being the most serious sin, you finally get to lust, which is kind of interpersonal. At least it's close to loving God. And then in heaven, you know, you move up from one thing to another. But it's the quality of love that determines where you come out, and that love is everywhere. Now, however, Dante says, he thinks about this for a while, and then all of a sudden we're in Canto 18. And Virgil says, you know, you can kind of hear Virgil saying, "I'm smelling wood burning. Is there something going on in your mind?" And Dante says, you know, what I don't get is, if love is offered from the outside, and if love motivates everything, why is anything ever wrong? You know? Why are some loves wrong if it's natural to us? Now, Virgil goes through, I'm not going to read this, I have it in my written text, and if we ever publish these anywhere, maybe we can go through it. But Virgil goes through this long academic, scholastic disquisition about how the primal affections of the soul are given by God, and this and this and this, and Dante's kind of scratching his head more and more, and Virgil comes to the end and he says, well, actually, that's as far as we pagans could get. That's as far as Plato and Aristotle could get. Really, free will is something that you'll have to ask Beatrice about when you're in heaven, and he does, and in Paradiso 5 she explains it to him. In this, Dante is not only making poetry out of this terminology that he draws from scholastic philosophy, he's also making a very interesting point that the historians of philosophy tell us, and that is that free will is a Christian idea that mostly starts with St. Augustine, that the ancients had an idea of choice, but they didn't have an idea of free will in the way that we would think about free will. And so Dante respects Virgil. As much as he loves Virgil, Virgil is in limbo. Virgil will never be in heaven because he's a pagan. And his vision is a beautiful one. His vision for the Roman Empire is a beautiful one. It's sort of an anticipation of Christianity. But it is not Christianity. And Christianity brings an illumination and shows what loves are and how freedom has to be coordinated with the truly good and the truly beautiful. Right after this, Dante has a dream. So he falls asleep. And we've just had this kind of poetry of philosophy in 17 and 18. And here's what happens. Let me just back up for a second here. What happens is Dante has a dream about this beautiful lady who is actually the siren, you know, like the siren in the ancient pagan myths, who calls to mariners and then they crash on the rocks because they hear her singing beautifully and they're attracted to her. So it's a beauty of a kind. And then this dramatic thing happens. She says, you know, those who dwell with me rarely depart, so much do I content them. And Dante tells us, her lips had not yet closed when at my side appeared a lady, holy and alert, in order to confound her. Oh, Virgil, Virgil, who is this? She asked, indignant. And he came forward with his eyes fixed on that virtuous one. The other he seized and, ripping her garments, laid her front bare and exposed her belly. The stench that came from there awoke me. So, coming right after that disquisition about the different kinds of love, Dante shifts to a different kind of poetry here, a different art of beauty, and says that there are deceptive and even destructive kinds of beauty if we don't have the illumination. We have to assume that the lady here is Beatrice, although the scholars kind of, you know, the scholars dispute everything with one another, but it has to be Beatrice because she speaks to Virgil. You know, she already knows Virgil. She was down in hell with Virgil before. Virgil, you know, why are you letting this happen? And then he operates. And, you know, we have to read these persons at times as meaning more than just those individual persons. And here, probably what we're seeing is divine grace in the person of Beatrice, speaking to human reason in the person of Virgil. These are not always the case. I mean, it's not a kind of a crude allegory like that. But divine grace coming down, inspiring human reason to see that there's something wrong, reason opening up this deceptive beauty, and showing that, in fact, it's destructive, and that other beauties, the large structure, Dante wakes up at that point and returns to the large structure of the Paradiso, the Purgatorio. Now, I'm going to drop Dante for a minute. Let me just try to go through this very fast because we're getting near the end of our time. I have the impression that this whole series is somewhat inspired by that famous saying of Dostoevsky's that beauty will save the world. And I have to say, I've always been suspicious about that saying because, like the siren, it often seems to me, I've lived in Washington for 30 years, so please forgive me. It seems to me that beauty often, instead of saving the world, wrecks the world because it's the wrong kinds of beauty. But that saying, which is from Dostoevsky, or at least it's from Prince Mishkin and the Idiot, that saying was picked up by other very, very serious people. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, St. John Paul II. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said that he himself used to be very suspicious of this saying that beauty will save the world until he'd been through the horrors of war and then through the gulag, because he was put in the gulag after World War II. And in his it's in his Nobel lecture in 1970 that he repeats this from that phrase from Dostoevsky, and he says a very interesting thing. Let me read this to you. He said, a work of art bears within itself its own verification. Conceptions which are devised or stretched do not stand being portrayed in images. They all come crashing down, appear sickly and pale, convince no one. But those works of art which have scooped up the truth and presented it to us as a living force, the truth now, They take hold of us. They compel us. And nobody ever, not even in ages to come, will be able to refute them. So perhaps the ancient trinity of truth, goodness, and beauty is not simply an empty, faded formula, as we thought in the days of our self-confident and materialistic youth. If the tops of these three converge, as the scholars maintained, but the two blatant, two direct stems of truth and goodness are crushed, cut down, not allowed through, in other words, the culture doesn't allow us to see them, then perhaps the fantastic, unpredictable, unexpected stems of beauty will push through and soar to that very same place that truth and goodness were at. And in so doing, will fulfill the work of all three. It's a very interesting way of thinking about it. And I won't read you John Paul II, but he pretty much talks about the same thing. I'd like to recommend a little book to you in this regard. It's an extraordinary little book by Joseph Pieper called Enthusiasm and Divine Madness. And what Pieper says there is that very often these little cracks in our personalities are the places that grace is able to enter. It's a thing that he gets from Plato, that sometimes it's illness that enables people to see things that were in their everyday life had closed them down to. Sometimes it's a kind of a divine inspiration. Sometimes it's sin itself. But then there's also beauty. There's also the beauty, the catharsis that comes from the muses. I want to turn just to a couple passages in closing from the Paradiso. I know that's not my subject, but just to give you a sense of the heights that the beauty can reach, because we've seen some of the structural things, we've seen some of the more mundane ways that Dante talked about different things, but unless we really see how he comes out with Paradiso in the end, you don't really get this lifting up that Solzhenitsyn was talking about, where the good and the true kind of converge with the beautiful. Here's a passage in Canto 33 of Paradiso, in other words, the last canto of the Divine Comedy. So Dante is drawing very close now to the beatific vision and unity with God himself. He talks about how all the loves in the universe are bound together, and he uses scholastic language. O plenitude of grace, by which I could presume to fix my eyes upon eternal light, until my sight was spent on it. In its depth I saw contained by love, into a single volume bound, the pages scattered through the universe, substances, accidents, and the interplay between them, as though they were conflated in such ways that what I tell is but a simple light. Now, if you sat with this text and you could read it yourself, you'd see that he's going between imagery that is just purely sensuous, light, you know, a book, the book of the universe bound, the pages drawn together, and then he just jumps into this philosophical language, substances and accidents, and it all seems to adhere. You know, he's able to bring this conceptual side of philosophy into relationship with the beauty that he is able to create. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was a big debate among poets about whether conceptual material could enter into poetry. And there's a famous essay on Dante by T.S. Eliot, which I encourage you to read as well, from his book The Sacred Wood. And what Eliot says there is that if we can't have conceptual material in works of art, then it means our works of art are closed off to one of the powers that God gave us, which is our ability to reason, our ability to philosophize and to do theology. So to bring that material in is part of presenting a full vision of humanity. Now, you know, the usual modern objection to bringing in ideas is that ideas tend in the modern world to become ideology, and ideologies tend to be a narrower presentation of reality than the broader presentation of reality. But that's just because we exist in a rather unusual time. We don't have the kind of background that Dante had in scholastic philosophy and theology that really opened things up and gave him a structure. Our artists, as I'm sure some of you are in this room, have to deal with a much more diffused, confusing situation. I always think of Flannery O'Connor in these circumstances, that those bizarre stories that she tells, they open something up. You know, they take what is our normal way of thinking rationally about the world, and they bring something new into our minds. But still, it's worth recalling that somewhere along the way, truth, the kind of truth we can apprehend, must find its way into even our most exalted works of art. And Dante certainly did it, I believe, in that passage. Let me quote to you the very last lines of Paradiso, because they're so beautiful. And again, this is Dante. He's just such a great genius. He starts talking about this. He's only, you know, 15 lines from seeing God. And what is he thinking about? How we can't rationally determine the number pi. You'll see when I read this that, you know, squaring the circle means, you know, if you ever took high school geometry, you learned that it's 3.22, and you know they had supercomputers working on this for years, and it just keeps going. You know, there's no, it's called a rational number, right? There's no rational number that can describe the relationship of a diameter of a circle to the, or radius of a circle to the circumference. So he thinks about this as human reason trying to understand. He's seen Jesus in this circle, and this image comes to him. It's the human reason can't get there. So this is the way he ends up with the poem. Like the geometer who fully applies himself to square the circle, and for all his thought cannot discover the principle he lacks, such was I at that strange new sight. I tried to see how the image fit the circle and how it found its where in it. But my wings had not sufficed for that, had not my mind been struck by a bolt of lightning that granted what I asked. Here my exalted vision lost its power, but now my will and my desire, like wheels revolving with an even motion, were turning with the love that moves the sun and all the stars. Beauty, truth, goodness all together. That's the art of beauty that I hope I've been able to convey a little bit to you from the Purgatorio. Thank you.